These are the people at the heart of racing. Their lives, their stories, in their own words.
Yeah, racing. I mean, that's where it started, Michael. That's really the beginning. That's where it burned as a kid.
We'll talk about the champion, Black Caviar.
Black Caviar was a freak. So was the trainer.
No, the first Melbourne Cup I was involved with was a horse called Gutum Gutum.
Gutum Gutum.
I was listening to an RSN interview with John Hawkes, and he said, I think it's a really average guineas this year.
This is a very sad story, but making sure that, you know, that his head was upright.
See TJ Smith or Bart Cummings in the background, and you're just in awe.
Follow a lot of sports, but the sport I follow most closely will be horse racing.
For the next hour, RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents Racing's Open Mic.
And a very special edition of Open Mic. It must be special because Jason's brought the recording camera in today, so we must have a special guest, and he is indeed very special, and he's been kind enough to join us for the next hour, and it's Luca Kamani. Welcome to Melbourne and welcome to the studio, Luca.
Thanks, Matt. It's a pleasure to be here.
I often wonder whether, when you're in Melbourne, whether it has bitter or sweet memories, given to our minds, the two most significant defeats of your career were narrow ones at Flemington. Is it a bittersweet town for you, Melbourne?
Well, definitely, but I love being here. Listen, it's being second twice is better than being nowhere twice, so it's still, I still have fond memories. Of course, it rankles a bit that Bauer had a faster time than the winner and yet was beaten.
There was the tracker on his saddle. Yeah, yeah, so yeah. You could nearly have lodged a claim there, couldn't you? Fastest horse doesn't always win. We'll talk in more depth about that and the timeline of your career, but obviously the significance of the last few months has been you made a very big decision about your life journey, didn't you, some months ago, and you're kind of in retirement now and on a bit of a retirement tour.
Yes, although I don't like to use the word retiring because I've never been either shy nor retiring, so I say that I've changed jobs. Because we, Sarah and I, are very lucky to have a stud farm that we built up over the years just outside Newmarket. And so I'm going from racing to breeding and very much looking forward to doing that. And I basically thought that having been a trainer for 43 years, it's been a long stint, one that I very much enjoyed, but it's been a long stint. And now is the time to sort of take it a bit easier and do something where there's a bit less stress. Not so many bosses around. one, probably the most difficult one.
I think we know who that is.
Yes.
And you've just...
I think having dealt with so many before, I think hopefully I can deal with just the one now.
You've had a nice road trip with the person we're mentioning, Sarah, too. I'll get back to the reasons why you decided to pull the plug after 43 years of a glittering career, but just on what's been happening right now, and it's a... You and I have been playing tag in the last week. I knew you were on a bit of a road trip down the coast of eastern Australia, and every time I gave you a tip about where to go, you're already a town ahead. So it started with your wonderful wife, Sarah, I imagine at the Gold Coast.
Yeah, that's where we started. We went there, and I think we left England on the 1st of January. Yes, we did. And we got there a day later, and we had a lovely time. We were there sort of to enjoy the sale, help Matt look at a few yearlings and help trying to get some yearlings from the sale. And at the same time, we were selling a yearling through Yarraman from a mare that we have in partnership with Terry Henderson and Francesca.
You did quite well with that,
didn't you? Did very well. And a very nice, I'm Invincible. That Arthur and Harry Mitchell prepared very well for the sale, and he made 525, and so we're very happy.
You mentioned helping Matt out a bit, and Matt's Terry was very helpful in helping set Matt up in Ballarat, but he's very much his own operator these days, and he's been here for two or three years now, and not without some assistance from you and Sarah as well, but he's done a terrific job. He had an awkward start with that strangle situation, but that's well behind him now, and he's been an active Magic Millions buyer in the last couple of years, hasn't he?
Yes, we helped him select the yearlings for the last couple of years, both at Magic Million and Karaka. This is the time of the year we can be here. Sadly, I'd love to come for the premiere, but by then our season is underway, and I like to be in England and following the racing there. So we bought four or five every year at boat sales. And so far it's been good experience.
Yeah. And this road trip, I think listeners are always fascinated by foreigner experiences of road trips. and you did a gargantuan trip with Sarah. So you set out 3 or 4 days ago, and you ended up at, it started in Sydney with Francesca and ended up with Matt and Ballarat, but in between you sort of zigzagged up and down and over a bit, didn't you? So where did this road trip take you in the last week or so?
Well, I can't exactly remember all the places we stayed, the name of the places, but it was wonderful. We set off from Sydney and went down the coast, and we visited some very nice places. As I say, I forgot the names of the places, but I...
Some lovely coasts down that way, though.
Down the coast, yeah. If you looked up on the map, I would be able to tell you. And then we took the road over the mountains back towards Wangaratta.
Wangaratta. Wangaratta, yeah. And that requires a monster drive over the roof of Australia, doesn't it?
Yeah, that was very enjoyable. It was a great scenery, very great scenes in the mountain. And then we ended up in Euroa and stayed the night with David Hayes at Lindsay Park, which was another great experience. And we enjoyed watching the training the next morning.
You, of course, grew up in Milan, and you've seen all of the world and won races in about 13 countries and seen everywhere. I guess every landscape's different. Was it a unique 3 or 4 days of sights and sounds?
It was most enjoyable, apart from possibly at times I felt that the driving was a bit too much, because some days we were driving 5-6 hours a day. But apart from that, it was always an interesting scenery. It changed so much, you know, from the coast to back inland. And I was amazed how green it was along the coast.
For summer.
Yeah. And then you go over the mountain and you get to the other side and it's all burnt off. But it's fascinating. The sea was fantastic. We stopped a few places to have a swim and relax on the beach, and it was great. And I didn't sort of check whether there were any sharks, but I didn't swim too far out from the beach.
They were there.
I'm sure they are.
So this is all possible now because your time is a bit freer than it had been for the previous 43 years, and you... Probably a variety of factors, I would imagine, but you made the decision midway through last year that it would be your last season of training. And I know that your career had a lot of huge peaks, but also some difficult times as well. Was it a culmination of things, or was it just simply time to stop?
No, I think it's just time to stop. I mean, otherwise, you know, you can go on forever, and then eventually it becomes almost too late to stop to do anything else. And I thought that training is quite intensive, and it's quite, apart from when you get your holiday break, the rest of the time you're on it 24/7 and probably 14, 16, 18 hours a day just working at it. So I felt that having done it for a long time, having won a decent number of races, obviously as a trainer, it's never enough. However many you win, you want more. But I just realized that, you know what, it doesn't really matter if I win another 5 Group 1 races. It doesn't change my life. It's not gonna change. I've been lucky so far. I'm healthy. We have a stud to go to that we built over the years. We have a nice number of mares, good clients, and we just finished building a house there. And I thought, well, it'd be nice just to do something different, just a change of jobs, basically.
You don't seem to be hugely sentimental, but I imagine Bedford House, where you've been since, I think, from the 1970s, and I read some stories from The Guardian and others about how wonderful the place itself was, with some lovely furniture and Shakespeare on the shelves and things like that. Is it? Have you sold it yet, or are you in the process?
No, it's not sold yet. We are waiting. We have some interested parties, and I think the discussions will become more serious when I go back.
And it would automatically be snapped up by another trainer, I imagine.
I imagine so. It could be that an owner might buy it and put a trainer in there. But I think it's such a wonderful place, and it's a lucky place. And we had 2 Derby winners from there, and the previous trainer before me had a Derby winner from there. So it's a lucky place. It's obviously good for horses to be stable there. It's very handy for all the gallops in Newmarket. It's probably one of the best positions stable in Newmarket.
How far is the stud from the former stables?
Oh, about 10-15 minutes, so just outside Newmarket.
And Sarah's been a major part of that operation, I believe, and you're not exactly a fledgling breeder now because you've had a bit of success with it in recent years. There's been a bit of crossover between the racing and the breeding, hasn't there?
Oh, yes. We started many, many years ago with just a couple of three mares and a small place, and then gradually over the years we've expanded it, and Sarah's been instrumental because she's always been the managing director, and I always call myself the chairman, and now I changed job title. I've gone from chairman to executive chairman, but I won't interfere much with what Sarah does there. She's basically in charge of the day-to-day operation.
I was going to say, despite what you call yourself, is she still in charge? No matter how many titles you claim. I think she is. And you've bred some good horses too. You're not a hobby breeder, are you?
No, we try to do it properly. I mean, we're lucky in the first, probably in the first 5 years that we were doing it. We bred a good horse called Milan. He was by Sadler's Wells, Sado Kithanga, who was a good mare that we had bred herself. And there was a multiple group winner. And Milan won the Ledger and won the Voltigeur and was second in the Breeders' Cup. And he's now a leading jump sire. And Kitanga produced another good filly called Cora, who won again. She was a group winner, and she now has her first foal by Dubawi, who's now actually a yearling just in the last few days, and will be probably going to the sales in the autumn.
How many broodmares do you have now?
About 18. And we try and be very selective. I don't want to have a big group of mares. I just like to have a good group of mares.
How do you match them to stallions?
Best I can. I think the most valuable lesson I've learned, or the most valuable dictum I've always learned, is that breed the best to the best and hope for the best.
Do you go speed to speed and stamina to stamina?
I try not to go to the opposites. I don't think a staying mare should go to a sprinter, because you may get something which is neither of the two. So a staying mare might go to a miler, just to make sure that she doesn't become too staying with the offspring, and I think a miler to a miler and a sprinter to a sprinter.
Well, we're going to talk about some of those great sprinters and milers and stayers that you've had over the years a little bit later on. There was a quote that I plucked out of a story when you decided to retire, and I think it sums up the difficulty of when there's so many giants around, and you came through the emergence of Godolphin and some of the others that came midway through your career, and you had to fend them off. And here we have a situation that Matt will tell you all about, with guys like Darren Weir and your mate David Hayes, who were just so big and strong that it's very difficult to make an inroad there. And a quote that I dragged out that you mentioned in this story was, "I've been to Churchill Downs in Melbourne, and now I've been having more runners at Wolverhampton and Chelmsford, and it's not quite the same." I guess as the giants get bigger, it gets more difficult to compete on the really, really big stages as regularly as you had been?
Of course it does. You need a lot of investment in decent horses in order to compete at the top. It's obviously, I mean, it's in any industry, the results are proportional to the investment that is put in. So if you haven't got the amount of money to spend to get the sort of potentially good horses, it makes it trickier. Yes, good horses can come out of anywhere, but they come out of well-bred yearlings more frequently than not.
We'll talk a little bit later on about the giants that you encountered throughout your career, and none more so than Henry Cecil and then the emergence of Godolphin. But as you departed the training scene, who were the, for those of our listeners who are vaguely aware of the situation in English racing, John Godston is enormous, but there are other trainers that we may not be that aware of who are huge numbers at Newmarket and other places, haven't they?
Yeah. Well, John Gosden has emerged in the last probably five years or so as the number one trainer in England, both with numerically and quality. He now trains for all the best outfits and all the best breeders and owners that there are in Europe. And obviously he's a great trainer and wins lots of big races. Willie Haggas has emerged in the last 10 years. years or 15 years as well, as a force to be reckoned with. He has a good string, has a big string with very well bred horses, and he's probably him and Michael Stout, who's still a very strong force, right sort of and neck and neck behind Goslin in strength. So it's very competitive. You know, European racing is very, very competitive. You have the big outfits of Godolphin and Coolmore, and then you have Judmont, of course, which is a high quality outfit, and then all the various other Arabs like Sheikh Hamdan and so forth. So it's very competitive.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to ask you a little bit later on about what it was like for an Italian to try and break into the traditional staunch ranks of Newmarket. Just on John Gosden, and the only reason I mentioned is because Winx was given this equal global rating with Cracksman at a big awards night in London last night, and she's our darling, of course, and I know you would have seen a little bit of her, but John Gosden is the trainer of Enable, and she, in your neck of the woods, is the Winx at the moment, isn't she?
She definitely is. We're talking about two different distances. I mean, Enable is very, very strong over a mile and a half. She's almost unbeatable, and Winx is definitely unbeatable at anywhere around a mile, maybe even a mile and a quarter. So there's different distances, so I don't think they'll ever meet. And it's interesting because it makes for fun and interest to speculate.
And which
one is the better?
Which one are you going to speculate?
I'm not speculating. They're both champions at different distances.
You are in a Melbourne studio.
But I'm an Italian, so I'm European. Look, it's impossible. We're blessed to have two such fantastic racehorses racing at the same time in two different parts of the world. They're just as good as each other, and they will never find out who's better, because there'll never be a distance at which they can meet.
That's right. And Cracksman's the other one. John Hammond was in this studio not long ago, and he was talking about Montjeu and how Montjeu was a cranky colt who needed to be cajoled into action. And Cracksman, the other great horse of Europe at the moment, and really interested in your observations of him, he seemed like he was a lot of hard work for Frankie to crank into gear for a few of those races this season.
Yeah, strange enough, because he seemed to be a very straightforward horse in his three-year-old year, and yet he came back as a four-year-old, and he seemed to be almost sort of too laid back or not caring enough about being competitive. And he lost his way a little bit in the summer. But John Gosden did a marvellous job to bring him back in the autumn and win the Champions Stakes in such emphatic style.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to talk about your Italian heritage, and if anyone thinks of style and class and urbaneness, they think of Milan, and the picture is absolutely perfect, and that's where we're going to start after the break. It's 23 minutes after 9. You're listening to a special edition of Open Mic, and my guest is Luca Camani.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
Well, it's 27 minutes past 9 and my guest is Luca Camani, and you can partially gather from the accent that there's an Italian in there somewhere. It's very polished now because Luca spent so many years in England. But Luca, the story begins in Milan, where both mum and dad were very horsey types, weren't they?
Yeah, definitely. My father was a trainer for many years. Unfortunately, he died quite young. He was 56 when he died, but he had been champion trainer for 10 years. And my mother, who had never seen a horse in her youth, when she married, she decided that she better get involved. And so she started riding, and she became very good. She won the title, amateur title, over the jumps, beating all the boys 1 year as well. So I grew up in that environment, started with ponies and show jumping and little events and so on. And then gradually started riding in races. As an amateur, bird flat and jumps, and I was lucky enough 1 year to be the European champion and winning the big race at the time. That was a very big race for amateurs and at Epsom on the Derby course, and I won that on a horse trained by Ian Boulding of Mill Reef fame.
Yeah.
And that basically got me introduced to English racing. Then I went and had some stints during summer holidays working in Newmarket, first for Johnny Winter, and then eventually I got a job as assistant trainer to Henry Cecil, and was there for 3 years, and then I took the plunge, and it was a good time for Italian racing and Italians. There were good Italian horses that were coming over and winning in England, such as Bolkonski and Wallow, and then Italian owned horses like Grandi, and so there were lots of Italians coming coming racing in England, and they sort of, I was a bit of a reference point for them. They were coming up to me and asking me for tips and what I thought would win the next, and so on and so forth. And then a few of them started saying, "Why don't you start training? I'll send you a horse." And of course, if they'd all sent me a horse, all the ones that said it, I would have probably started with 150 horses. But as it was, I was lucky enough to start with about 20, and kick on from there.
Yeah, you kicked on big time. What was Italian racing like then? I know it must sadden you probably, even though you probably foresaw the state that Italian racing might end up in. Martin Seidel is a German jockey who's out here at the moment, and he'd done some riding in Italy last year, and he said, "Oh, the state of Italian racing is just terrible at the moment." What was it like when you emerged through the ranks, and what's your observation about where it's at now?
Well, as you probably know, many, many, many people of a certain age may recall, Italian racing was great between the wars. Federico Tezio dominated European racing from Italy, and there were many, many other big outfits. And in fact, Italians have a very good record in the arc, not just Ribo winning it twice, but also who was called Molvedo, and another one called... I think it was called Prince Royal, and so it was good. But unfortunately, since the 60s, 70s, the decline started setting in, and I was lucky that basically I got a good offer to work in England, and then I took the plunge and stayed there, because nowadays Italian racing is really, really down to on its knees. If you think that they have a full crop of about 800 horses, 800 horses born a year, it just tells you about how bad it is, the situation.
It must be a lesson for other advanced Western countries too, because Italy had a long history of racing. It was an advanced country, yet for whatever reason its racing fell off the perch and is now in a desperate state. How did it get to that stage?
Well, look, it's difficult to point the finger at any one reason. I think one of the major reasons was that up until about 10, 15 years ago, it was the only form of legalized betting. And then the other form of sports betting opened up. People that run racing didn't see it coming, didn't adjust. It appears that there's less tax or takeout on sports betting than there is on racing. So the betting dollar shifted from racing to other forms, and that started the rot. And then I suppose there's many other reasons as well, but that probably was the principle.
Well, it's a salient lesson, because we've got one state of Australia that's on its knees, South Australia, and we've got this era of corporate bookies and tax issues and so on as well. So whatever Italy experienced, I'm sure there are warning signs everywhere else as well. Luca, I want to ask you in a minute about what it was like as an Italian breaking into the training ranks at Newmarket, which my impression would be stuffy and traditional in English, but in the meantime it might have been a bit of a soft entry, because you went to work for Henry Cecil.
That's right. Yeah.
How did that come about, and what was Henry Cecil like?
Well, it was great. When I was working for Johnny Winter one summer, there was an advert in the racing paper, Henry Cecil looking for pupil assistant. So I went up to him and I said, "My name is Luca Cumani." And he said, "Oh, I know who you are, and I heard of your father. And didn't you win the amateur derby last year?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Can I have a job?" And thinking, well, he'd probably say no, because why would he want a wop like me to work for him? And he said, "Yes," surprisingly. So
he might have thought you could cook.
He was looking forward to a good bowl of spaghetti.
So, with great relief to you, you started working for this mystical sort of trainer. So big, he was a god, wasn't he, Sir Henry Cecil?
He became, at the time he'd only been training about 6-7 years, but he already was the second largest numerical trainer in Newmarket. And just to tell you how much things have changed, in those days he had 60 horses, and that was considered a big number. Nowadays trainers have 200, 250 horses, and so it just goes to show how things have evolved and changed.
Well, you had 200 in work at one stage, and then they were halved with a recession, but Sir Henry Cecil, there's a quote that I found from you. He said and all about hard work, and he said he likes to give the impression that he floats around and doesn't care much, but he works at least as hard as anyone else. And was that the myth of Sir Henry, that he just drifted around, but he still had 60 or 80 horses to work, didn't he?
No. He gave all, he always had that impression that he was very relaxed and very laid back. But deep down inside, he was incredibly competitive. You know, he would have done anything to get his hands on a good horse, and he did quite often as well. And but he as you said, he floated around on the race course, always immaculately dressed. Happy to chat to anybody, happy to be, especially his great thing, he always wanted to be loved by everybody, whether it was a down and out punter on the street corner or a very important owner. Henry always liked to be loved by everybody, and he would spend time talking to anybody in order to be liked and loved by them. And he had this great flair with horses. You know, he could see things in horses that other people can't.
Were you able to see those things after working with him for a while, or was it exclusively his talent?
I think it was his talent, and I think I saw something different that was about good enough, but not quite as good as what he saw.
He had a thing for flowers, didn't he? Roses?
He grew roses in his garden, yes. I think it was made a bit more out of it than actually... I mean, he had a good gardener, and he loved pretending he'd done it all. But he would take you around the rose garden and name the roses. and that was another part of him, you know, just a bit of a showman.
Was it seen in England? Because when Frankel came along, I don't think anyone was quite aware how ill Sir Henry was. But then he died not long after Frankel's career ended. Was it seen that Frankel was almost a bit of a heavenly gift at the very end for Sir Henry?
Oh, definitely. I think also Frankel probably kept him alive for another year or two during his, because Henry wasn't prepared to give up until it finished with Frankel. And I think that when Frankel retired, that was a sort of the end of a career. And how better to finish your career than train a horse like Frankel?
Michael Canaan was here in the spring, and we put it to him that the best horse of recent times was See the Stars, and then Frankel came along and sort of swept the carpet, and he said, oh, hang on a moment. He thought See the Stars was every bit as good as Frankel. Is Frankel clearly the best horse you've seen in your lifetime?
I think you have to think so, because certain performances of him stands out, like the Guineas, the 2000 Guineas. I mean, to make all the running and gradually go further and further and further away from the rest of the field and win by a record margin was astonishing to say the least. And also various other performances in the Sussex and in the Judmont were amazing. And he was a very beautiful, masculine, strong horse. And yes, you would have to say that he's the best I've seen.
Well, you had a few good ones yourself, and we'll talk about those too. But just quickly, the idea of an Italian breaking into the traditional ranks of Newmarket, was that a difficult process at all?
I didn't find it so. I think that it might have been in the eyes of some people. Maybe some people never sent me a horse because they thought, what's the point sending a horse to an Italian when we're in England? And so that might have happened to some people, but I never felt any hostility. It probably helped that I married an English girl. In fairness, I've been treated very fairly. And never felt any hostility, and always got on well with the Brits.
Where did you meet Sarah?
Ah, that's a long story. I met her at a drinks party. She was there, and I asked somebody to introduce me to her, and that was in Newmarket, the drinks party, and I just started training. And so this person moved up to her and said, Sarah, this is Luca Cumani, and Luca, this is Sarah Plunkett. And he said to Sarah, Luca is from Italy, so Sarah was holding a gin and tonic in one hand. She looked at me up and down, and I said, you're an immigrant. And I said, can you ride? And she said, yes, of course I can, quite assured. And so I said, do you want to ride out tomorrow morning? She said, of course. And I said, okay, come along at 7 and we'll find your ride. So she rode the horse, and she rode very beautifully and very confident, too confident. And at the end of the canter that the horse was doing, he threw a bit of a shape and she fell off. So I rode up to her on my pony and I said, I thought you could ride. How about dinner next week?
Sounds like something out of a Mills and Boone novel. So that was that.
And that was well, that.
How could she
resist? That was dinner the following week. And she was living in London at the time. So I went and picked her up and went down. We went to the theatre and went to dinner and then gradually started from there.
Well, there you go. What a great love story that is. And then, of course, the product of this relationship is your two famous children as well. So, and we might even touch on them a bit later on as well. But, Luca, it's impossible to talk about your race wins and where they were and who they were because there were so bloody many of them. And the Great Britain list as well, like two derbies and then every other feature race. But there were certain horses that come along that have a bit of an attachment here. And certainly there was one that was probably the best you trained. And he came at a time in your career at exactly a bit like not quite the Frankel Sir Henry Cecil story, but certainly Felbrev came along after a very difficult time. You had the Aga Khan in tow and another Sheikh, I think Muhammad. And the Aga Khan seems to be a fickle type of owner, and he's moved around a bit, and he moved a lot of horses out at a certain time, and thankfully a good horse was just around the corner.
Yeah, that was I think the Aga Khan left sort of late 90s, and I think he was looking for an excuse. He's never been in love with English racing as such, and he's always preferred obviously France because he lives there and Ireland because his studs are there. And so he was never really totally comfortable with English racing, even though Sir Michael and I won him derbies. He then had the dispute over a filly that won the Oaks with the Jockey Club, a filly called Alisa, trained by Sir Michael. And he fell out with the establishment in England and the Jockey Club and everything and decided to take all his horses away. And then he made a short comeback, and then obviously he didn't really enjoy that match and took the horse away. I don't blame him. Look, I never blamed an owner for moving horses. I think that it hurts. I think it is at times, I'd say, very hurtful. But at the end of the day, they own the horses. They can do what they like. And the same happened with Sheikh Mohammed Ubaid, for whom I trained 20 years and won a derby. And the week after we won the King George and Queen Elizabeth, which is the most prestigious older race for older horses in England, a week after that he told me that he was moving his horses. So it's part of the job.
Did you have to literally rebuild, or was the stable still strong enough to ride that out?
After the Aga Khan?
Yeah, both, I suppose. Yeah.
After the Aga Khan, we were still strong enough because we had, just before he left, we had Barathea, who won the Breeders' Cup, amongst them, and many other big races. And we won the Derby with High Rise in 98. So we were going along strong. And it was a bit then what happened, unfortunately, after the Aga Khan left. Gerald Lee, who had a fantastic breeding operation and bred some many, many good horses, amongst those were Barathea and Marco Distinction, and many other group horses. Unfortunately, he died, and his children didn't carry on his operation. And so that was a bit of a blow, because I was the number one trainer for him, and so I had access to very, very well-bred horses to train. And he was a great man and a personal friend. And then luckily, Falbrav came, and two good horses came along in quick succession, Falbrav and Starcroft, who came from Australia. And Falbrav was trained in Italy before he joined us as a five-year-old, and he ran 10 times for us that year, all Group 1 races, and he won 5 of them, and should have won 6 because he was nearly put over the rails by Mickey Nan in the Irish Champion Stakes, and was beaten a short head with the jockey unable to ride because he was squeezed in between High Chaparral and the rails. And he nearly won the Breeders' Cup Turf as well, over a mile and a half, which was stretching him. And he was in front all the way by the last 50 yards and was beaten ahead. So he was a fantastic horse. And then he gave his best performance still in Hong Kong at the end of a long, long, long season, when he absolutely bolted up in the Hong Kong feature race in December. He was a great horse. He was a real bull of a horse, strong horse, pleasure to train.
I'll ask you about StarCraft in a minute, but Maddie told me that you're very glass half empty about the quality of your horses. You prefer to let them really prove it. And there was a copy of the Racing Post around the kitchen table at Bedford House, and it declared Felbrav the best horse in the world. And your reaction was sort of, yeah.
Well, no, that was a little bit controversial because I was so cross after what happened in Ireland that I really was determined to prove that he was the best horse in the world at the time. And so we ran him back about, was it probably 3 weeks later in the Queen Elizabeth, bringing him back to a mile. Mile and a quarter is always his best trip. He'd won it in the Eclipse and the Judgment over that trip. But we brought him back to a mile to prove how versatile he was. And the Queen Elizabeth is one of the major races for milers in England. And and I said before in the interview before the race that he was the best horse in the world because he was still rankling with me the fact that he got beaten in Ireland. And luckily I got away with it because he then won the Queen Elizabeth very, very easily. So.
Well, there you go. And I've got a StarCraft replay coming up and then we'll talk about those near misses in the Melbourne Cup. But there were a couple of niches that you found as a trainer, and one of them was specialising in low handicap horses in big races, getting the handicap down and pouncing, even though you weren't a punter. I think it was just an exercise that you like to pull off. And the other one I read about was you would take good two-year-olds to bad venues and then they would get a certain handicap for their next race and that would make them almost unbeatable. What was a couple of those little tricks of the trade that you executed there?
Well, it's all part of the same thing. I sort of worked it out that the handicappers would give you a different rating depending on where you won your race. So the tradition for trainers in England was that early in the three-year-old year, you run your best horses at places like Newmarket or Ascot or York, your second best horses at a grade lower like Leicester or Nottingham, and your moderate, what you thought of moderate three-year-old maidens, you run them at far flung outside the country venue. And so I thought to myself, and you got a much lower rating obviously for winning at a small track, so I thought, how about doing it the other way around and run your best three-year-old maiden in a godforsaken place, if you like, in the country, get a very low rating and then go into a big handicap. And in those days you could do that because you only needed to win a race before you went into your qualified for handicap. Now you need to run three times, so by the time you run three times your horse is much more exposed and the handicap has got a better handle. But in those days it couldn't get a handle on the horse because it only just won a couple of lengths at say Carlisle or Retka, and so you got into a big Goodwood or Newmarket or Ascot handicap of a very low weight, and it worked for a while.
It did. You had a lot of those sort of winners. I'm going to listen to a little replay now of one of StarCraft's wins overseas, and we're going to have a chat about the big chestnut Aussie who came into your stables.
Here's Dubawi on his outside from Blayton, sleeping Indian. Rackney's starting to flounder out in the centre. StarCraft with a rail, though, is finding plenty. He's about a neck in front. Dubawi trying hard to wear him down. StarCraft sticking to his guns. The Aussie's too good. StarCraft wins the QE2.
Bit of a measure, Luca, of a good Aussie horse versus a good European horse. I remember years ago asking you about Felbrav and StarCraft, and you said, well, Felbrav was a significantly better horse, but StarCraft was still a very good horse. And there was an interesting story with StarCraft about running on the dirt in the Breeders' Cup in America.
Well, that was, yes, that was interesting. That was probably not my idea. I wanted to go for the mile because he was a miler, and he just won the Queen Elizabeth and the Moulin over a mile on turf, and that would have been the safe option.
But his owner was Paul Makin, wasn't
he? Paul Makin, yes. And Paul Makin doesn't do safe. He does extraordinary. And so he said that he couldn't care less about winning over a mile. The horse had nothing to prove over a mile. And he wanted to do something extraordinary, like running on dirt over a mile and a quarter. And obviously that didn't work out. And he then also wanted an American jockey, which I was against. Not because I don't like American jockeys by any means. I think they're great jockeys. But you need on a horse like StarCraft, he wasn't an easy horse. He was a horse that could easily boil over at the races. He could be difficult to ride. He was such a big, strong horse that sometimes he just took charge and wanted to do what he wanted to do. So you always needed to sort of keep the lid on him, and you needed a person who understood how to keep a lid on him. To get a jockey that had never seen the horse before, just to get a leg up the day of the race and ride him and expect him to know what to do exactly would have been, was a tough ask. And in fact, the horse took charge from the gate, and it just didn't work. Well, listen, full marks to Paul for trying.
He had to fork out about $800,000 for the privilege too, didn't he, to get the horse in the race? I think there was a big entry cost to get into that race.
Yes, yeah. Yes, but Paul never really flinched. And after the race, we had dinner that night, and he didn't seem to be too bothered. And Paul was a great winner and a great loser, and he was a great character.
Hard to be a great winner and a great loser, isn't it? It's 11 to 10. We're going to take a really short break, Mikey, short break, and we're going to come back with a couple of those near misses at Flemington.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
Laser Sharp runs on, zipping, and the Fisheter's coming down the outside. Purple Moon for Raleigh, got to Marla now. Here comes the Fisheter, he's mowing them down out wide. Purple Moon in front, Fisheter the only danger. Purple Moon in front, Fisheter's getting there. Fisheter getting to Purple Moon, Fisheter's going to win the cup. Half a length to Purple Moon, 3 lengths to Marla. Zipping fourth, and then Dolphin Joe on a turn.
Bit stiff there running into Efficient in your first serious Melbourne Cup bid, Luca. You'd won big Group 1 races in 13 different countries, but the itch that was still left to scratch when you retired was the Melbourne Cup. And you'd had other runners before, but that was the first time you'd ever been at Flemington with Purple Moon, and the first of two near misses. I guess the scale of the event at Flemington was probably the first thing that blew you away.
Totally. I mean, when I came the first time, and we had two horses that weren't good enough, that of Paul Makin's, that had decided that it'd be fun to do it. And I was completely blown away by the size of the event. And by that I mean the scale of the event, the build-up, the participation of people that are maybe not necessarily racing people, whose interest is amazing for the week leading up to the Melbourne Cup, and then on Cup Day itself. And so I said to myself, this is a great event. I've always been a great sort of international trainer, if you like, because I always thought that if you want racing to go to the next stage, you've got to make it more international. Mm-hmm. And so I've then participated in the Melbourne Cup as often as I could when I had a horse that had a chance. But I was determined to come back with horses with chances, not the ones I came with.
Well, you are bar for an inch here and there. You were completely correct in your estimation. All around the world where you won races, and I know everything's unique and so on, is there anything that's as vast as the whole Flemington experience with the 100,000 people?
There is on the day, of course. Races like the Arc or the Breeders' Cup or the Derby or so on the day are fantastic events. But nothing beats the event leading up, as it is in Melbourne. You just can't get away from the fact that the cup is going to be run in a few days' time from the moment you land in Melbourne, and every street corner, every restaurant, every bar, everybody's talking about the cup coming up, and so you can't beat that. I mean, it's a wave of enthusiasm and interest in the race that doesn't happen in other countries.
Another thing that you can't beat is Bart Cummings at Flemington. You tried with Bauer. Let's have a listen to see how that worked out. That was an amazing call by Greg Miles, who nominated Viewed, even though Viewed didn't complete the course quicker than Bauer. And Bauer was an OTI horse, and I know you're good friends with Terry Henderson. And there's a great image after that race. You and Francesca were down the front, down near the winning post. You looked at her and she looked at you, and I reckon your expression was, Did we? I don't think we did. Was that what that expression was?
Well, as you said earlier, I tend to be more glass empty than glass full, because I'd rather be surprised positively than be disappointed. And so I sort of convinced myself that we were beaten, hoping to hear that we had actually won. But there's an amusing story about that. About 10 minutes after the result was announced, I got a text on my phone from a friend of mine who's Jewish, and the text said, "Next year, take a Jewish horse; they got longer noses."
Well, Viewed had a longer nose. He was yes. of that denomination, seemingly, and he did complete the course slower than you did. And there were other Melbourne Cup bids. Did that become an obsession or just a desire, or do we make a little bit too much out of the endless quests for people to win the Melbourne Cup?
Well, it's like when people say, "Why do you want to go on top of Mount Everest?" And people say, "Because it's there." And why do you want to win the Melbourne Cup? It's because it's there. It's one of the great events in the racing calendar. It's one of the biggest races in the world. Why do you want to win it? Because it's there. And so it became I wouldn't say an obsession, but it became part of the search of winning big races. And so we came back with Mount Athos twice, and he ran two good races, finishing third and fourth. And we would have come back with others if we had the right horse. It's getting harder and harder to win the Melbourne Cup. You need a better and better horse.
Even since that era, the 2007 and 2008 of Purple Moon and Bauer, I think a lot's changed in the decades since. Would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. A horse like Bauer wouldn't even get in today. In those days, you needed an improving handicap, and nowadays you need an improving group horse.
Yeah.
And so it's gone up. It's gone up two or three notches.
Well, the challenge now, you've got a multi-pronged attack now, because you've got Young Matt up at Ballarat, whose next accomplishment will be to find a really good horse, and that might be a Melbourne Cup horse, and who knows, you may be involved in that, and your role and Sarah's role is to breed one. So you've got a couple of chances there. Are you in some way in the back of your mind when you look at those 18 broodmares thinking, "I hope we can win a Melbourne Cup with something in this paddock"?
Hopefully, yes. I mean, the overriding aim is to win a British Classic, obviously, because we're based there. But then if we can't do that, the Melbourne Cup would do very nicely, thank you.
And he's very good at training sprinters, I've noticed, and he's very good at training all sorts of horses, as is Archie, the other Englishman up there. How, with the vibe you're getting from, and this is with our punter listeners in mind looking for a winner, with the vibe you're getting off Matt, is there a nice wave of nice horses coming through his stable?
Look, when there's horses, there's always hope. And so there's always hope that some of the two-year-olds are going to be nice. I can't be specific because I've only just got there yesterday and today I'm here. But as from tomorrow, I'll be out every morning with him and looking around. So I'll be able to form some idea of what kind of material he's got. And hopefully there's going to be some good ones, yes.
You do realise it's going to be 41 degrees in Ballarat tomorrow.
It's still better than -6 in Newmarket.
That's true. So with 60 seconds left of this chat, Luca, when you look at the next 5 years, what do you think?
Hoping to stay alive and stay healthy, hoping to breed a good horse, hope to have a bit of fun, and as I say, just keep travelling, keep coming out here. I love Australia. I wish I had more time to be out here longer. And I love Melbourne, I love Sydney, I love the coast, and I love the racing here. Everything about Australia has always been very fascinating to me, and grateful to be able to be here.
Except for the flying bit. I believe you're a major jet lag sufferer.
I used to be. I now find a way of not suffering jet lag when I fly out here. I just sleep all the time. Don't eat, don't drink, just sleep.
Sitting up the front end of the plane usually helps as opposed to the back end.
The middle. It's good enough.
Luca, it's been a great pleasure for me, a great honour for me to have a chat to you in the studio, and best of luck with sort of fending off the heat up at Ballarat tomorrow, and look forward to the next time we have this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Matt. It's been a great pleasure to be here.
Luca Kamani, on tomorrow's show, the Shark joins me from 9 as we dissect the Australia Stakes meeting at Moonee Valley and the Blue Diamond preview meeting at Caulfield. But for now, it's 10 o'clock, time for a sports update.